good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this week
you're listening to episode 696 of Unwelcome Guests, the morality play of austerity, bailing out the shipwrecked plutocracy. I'm Robin Upton, and we have a very crowded show for you this week. I hope it will clarify for you just how arbitrary this talk about austerity budget cuts actually is. We begin with an interview from 2013. This is Doug Henwood interviewing Mark Blyth, Professor of International Political Economy at Brown University and author of Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea, published in 2013.
Welcome, Mark Blyth. First of all, tell us about your background. This talk of austerity actually is rather personal for you.
It is. Hagen, where would I start? I grew up in Dundee in the late 60s, early 70s and into the 80s. I was the original child of Thatcher. So I'm well aware of the effects of budgetary consolidations, having seen them firsthand. And there's an asymmetry in all of this that gets buried in this idea that we're all going to tighten our belts because we're all wearing the same pants, which is we're not all wearing the same pants, and we seldom are. And when we talk about budgetary consolidation, you're talking about basically taking resources away from the least advantaged members of society in the name of asset protection for those who already have the most. And that's really what this story is. So when the G20 come out with a communique that says growth-friendly fiscal consolidation, that rings an alarm bell that I've heard before, that essentially says somebody's in a creditor-debtor standoff. The creditors want their money back. The debtors can't pay, so we're going to take it by any means necessary.
And you make it clear that a lot of this austerity really is just making sure there's enough money to give the banks, right?
Yeah, behind it all, particularly in the European story, this is a banking crisis. And we kind of missed this in the United States because, in a sense, we dealt with it. Now, one of the interesting things for me in the bank during the book is discovering how much of the banking crisis that happened here resonates very strongly with Europe. But also because I started off as one of those folks that said, oh, well, you have to bail them, systemic risk, blah, 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 all the rest of it. And by the end of it, I became almost Tea Party-ish in terms of, no, let them fail. Because it's an extortion racket. And to continue an extortion racket is outrageous. But putting that to one side, the way that we dealt with it was we basically took the central bank and hosed down the banks, forced deleveraging and recapitalization, took the toxic assets off them, put them in the balance sheet of the Fed, and then you basically allow them to delever and recover. The economy is now in a positive growth cycle, even if the employment performance is terrible. That means credit's getting extended again. Businesses are rebuilding. We've got 2.8% for the year most likely coming out of this. And then as the economy recovers, you sell the assets back. So QE properly thought of as an asset swap. The Europeans can't do this. They've got a central bank which is more like a currency board. They're still fighting an inflation that died in 1924 as its only mandate. So being intellectually and institutionally unable to deal with it, they can't even really tell the European publics what's going on, which is you've got a banking sector which is essentially three times the size and twice as levered as the United States. It's interlinked, it's cross-border, even though everybody's effectively borrowing in a foreign currency. You've got national bank resolution mechanisms, but none of them will work because the states involved don't have their own printing presses. So you have a kind of gold standard in a democracy problem where you cannot inflate, you cannot devalue, you can't actually allow a default because it will blow up the core banks, hence why you've got to keep the Greeks in at all costs and squeeze them as hard as possible because it's a contagion trigger. And the only thing you're left with then is deflate, otherwise known as austerity, which I like to call squeeze, add liquidity, and pray. So what starts with the banks goes on with the banks. We managed to basically get through the cycle. The Europeans haven't even started to address the cycle.
Yeah, in contrast to the too big to fail, which is very familiar here, in Europe you have too big to bail, you say.
Exactly. When you add it together, the asset footprints of these banks relative to the GDPs of their sovereigns is astonishing. The French one is my favorite example. The top three French banks come out to about, depending on how you count it, 230 or 260% of GDP. The top four British banks, but at least they have their own currency, are nearly 460% of GDP. It's absolutely astonishing. So think about it, if you're running a bank that's running 40-to-1 leverage, which is not uncommon in the European Union, you don't actually control your own currency. You can't rely on a bailout from your own sovereign as a consequence of this. And what you end up with is a situation whereby these banks are just contingent liabilities, chock full of assets. A 3% turn against their assets means that they're illiquid, if not insolvent. And you can't remove the assets from the banking book. You've got a big problem.
Okay, let's go back and look at some of the histories of the crises on each side of the Atlantic. First, in the U.S., well, actually, this is true of both sides of the Atlantic. This is mainly a private sector crisis that has gotten retold as a public sector crisis. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. I call this the greatest bait and switch in human history. When the banking sector went bang in the United States in the 1920s, the incomes of the financial sector fell. And when they fell, that actually created the conditions after World War II for a more equal set of growth dynamics going across the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and that's the birth of the middle class in the United States and so on and so forth. This time, when we did the bailouts, what we did is effectively guaranteed the assets and the incomes of people who were already causing an income skew, which had gotten so bad that the United States is the same Gini coefficient as China. So we did income insurance for the top, and the way that we're going to pay for this is basically by cutting services at the bottom. It is a gigantic bait and switch.
Okay, now the United States, I think a lot of the listeners are probably familiar with the story of the housing bubble and the weird securities that helped finance it. But you write about the prevailing bad theory of risk management in the financial sector, in which the regulators also adopted. What do you mean by that?
Well, in this case, I was very much influenced by the work of good friend Nassim Taleb. And he's often seen as somebody who's much more on the libertarian side of things. But on this stuff, I think he's absolutely right. Essentially, the idea is that there's unpriceable risk out there. The common name for it is black swans. And if you're basically calibrating models, which are very, very precise but also very fragile, to data sets which are 6 or 7 years long and then projecting them 20 years ahead to price your mortgages, it's almost shocking that you're not totally wrong. So we get caught into this collective delusion with value at risk models and other types of models that rather than actually just measuring everybody else's data exposures in terms of the real exposures, what we're actually doing is missing what the real exposures are because we're kind of like drunks under the lamppost looking for where the data is. So the fixation on quantitative modeling, value at risk analysis, Basel weights, risk weight adjusted, etc., leads on the one hand to gaming and arbitrage and on the other hand to a mispricing of risk. So a very simple example of this is that if you basically have an asset bubble and a particular class of assets that are booming, let's call it housing, and people start to buy lots and lots of houses, well, as the price of those assets go up, there's a certain way in which when they're embedded into the portfolio, they're risk-adjusted downwards because they're seen as safe because they're in demand. So what's actually happening is your numbers are telling you you're safer when in actual fact you're buying a highly levered asset, so your real leverage ratios have been hidden. So there's lots of little perverse dynamics in the system that goes on because of the way that we do risk management in general. Now, this doesn't mean that like all models are bunk and all that sort of stuff. I don't want to go that far because ultimately we all use models implicitly or explicitly. And if the option of the alternative to this is basically just, you know, go with your gut, then how can I trust the gut anymore? But it's just that these models have built-in fragilities and blind spots to them, and we were dangerously unaware of those going into the crisis. When you add to that lots and lots of leverage and lots of complexity from derivative structures, you kind of build an accident waiting to happen.
Now, this all sounds perfectly clear in retrospect, but is it possible to know this in real time? Could people have foreseen this? Should they have known better?
That is always the difficult question, is this Monday morning quarterbacking. And, you know, Andrew Lowe from MIT's finance lab has a piece called something like Reading 21 Books on the Financial Crisis. And at the end of it, he kind of throws his hands up in the air and says, well, there's too many causes, too many effects, the whole thing's overdetermined, how could you possibly know? And, you know, that is the reality of the world. We're kind of hardwired to look for linear solutions in what is a very, very complex, nonlinear world. But there's certain things that you should be aware of. I mean, the first one is, if you calibrate your models for housing to the worst ever collapse has happened, and that's Texas in the 1980s where it goes down 40%, you've basically written off the possibility of a 50% drop in asset values at zero. That's a hell of a big assumption. If you're basically chucking lots of risky assets together and everybody's buying the same assets, you're building correlation into it at the same time you're actually trying to avoid the correlation of the assets. So in a sense, there were bits of the puzzle that we knew, but when you added it all up, what you needed to know was something that was an extremely unlikely event happening, which is basically all the liquidity in the world dries up as everybody tries to be liquid at once. And the warning for that was given in the back end of the general theory where Keynes says, there's nothing as noxious as the fetish of liquidity, where everyone tries to assume that which is private and discovers, in fact, that it's a very public affair. For somebody to be liquid, somebody else has to be illiquid. So if everybody tries to be liquid at once, you evaporate all the liquidity in the room, and all these highly levered structures, which seem perfectly stable at one point, suddenly become very unstable.
We can understand how the banks would not be wanting to ask too many questions. They were making lots of money, and it looked like they would be continuing to make a lot of money for a long time. But regulators are supposed to know better or act as if they know better. Are they just so captured by the interest that they're meant to regulate that they're not likely to step on any toes? Or they sort of fall prey to the same exuberance and delusion that private interests do?
Well, there's been some good work on this. I mean, Barth and Levine have a book, Guardians of Finance, that really takes the regulators to task on that side. And there's also Simon Johnson's book on the same thing, on sort of political capture. I'm actually more interested and more convinced by the notion of intellectual capture. I mean, nothing succeeds like success. So we have this story for 25 years that markets are good, states are bad, liberalization's the way to go, and things seem to work. And we went through the 87 crash and nothing really happened that much. We went through the dot-com crash and nothing really seemed to much happen that much. So there's all these stories out there about derivatives allow risk to be held by the people who are best able to hold it. And transparency is really all you need to know. And obviously these people have skin in the game and so on and so forth. So there's this wonderful correlative effect, whereby the story we tell correlates with the reality. And the longer it correlates, the more we confuse correlation and causation, and we believe that this is true. So if I was a regulator in 2004, I don't think I would be thinking hypercritical thoughts about the banking sector, because for the past 20 years, year on year, it had produced really, really solid positive returns, and no one had blown up yet, at least in the core. Now, the signal, of course, is, well, what about everywhere else? Around the world, there'd been 118 banking crises between 1970s, actually in the 1980s, 1990s alone. If you go back even to the developed world, I think the figure is from 1977 until the financial crisis in 2007, there are 17 developed world banking crises. But then we were always willing to blame someone else. Then it was crony capitalism. Then it was the tequila crisis, the Mexicans getting on over the head. Deep, developed, mature markets, we don't do that sort of stuff. So there's a kind of an implicit ethnocentrism that combines with this confusion of correlation and causation with stories we like about markets being good and states being bad to intellectually capture regulators as much as any political capture.
And we also like to tell tales to ourselves about the great moderation, which had supposedly taken over. We'd mastered the business cycle.
Yeah, that was a perfect example of this. And again, this is the correlation and causation one. Take the British example. You've got Gordon Brown banging on about prudence with a purpose. And Gordon comes in, and what does he do? He starts to pay back the national debt, and he drops British national debt to its lowest point, I think the 1860s. And he gets all these plaudits from it, and the economy takes off like a rocket, and the city of London is making all these profits. So, of course, the story is reduce your deficits, and you'll be rewarded by the markets. Well, there were lots of countries around the world that didn't do that, and they also rocketed. We were caught in the midst of a global credit bubble. But it's very hard to step outside of that bubble and see it for what it was, rather than basically tell your local irrational story as to how what you were doing somehow is the thing that's causing the boom. You don't have to be a venal credit claimer to make those kind of errors. So you end up with Gordon telling his story of prudence with a purpose, Ben tells his story of the great moderation, and everything seems to work fine until it doesn't, and then that's the big surprise.
And when the crisis first broke out in the U.S., some of the Europeans were kind of snooty about it, that this was an Anglo-Saxon crisis, and see, we told you so, you laissez-faire people do everything wrong, be more like us. And then they broke into crisis themselves. What was at the core of the European crisis?
The core of the European crisis is very similar to the American one. I mean, I alluded to it earlier, but to get to the heart of the matter, essentially their banking sector is even more interlinked and even larger and even more leveraged than the American was in 2006. So you have a bunch of global banks which have been borrowing in a foreign currency, going to American wholesale markets, setting up SIVs, chucking the money from the wholesale markets to buy mortgages, making profits off that, repatriating that back to the home country. They were up to all sorts of stuff. 70% of the SIVs involved in the mortgage crisis came from European banks. So these guys were knee-deep in it. So you had German politicians who have a uniquely blind way of looking at their own financial sector, as if what happens is somebody drops off money at the savings bank and then it shows up in the Mittelstand for BMW 5 days later, when in fact it's flying around global and local bond circuits and into in and out of derivatives markets. Deutsche Bank became one of the biggest players in global derivatives, which is a far cry from the sort of very solid sort of standard banking model that the politicians seem to assume they have themselves. So basically what happens was Greece tells the truth for the first time in 50 years about its deficit figures. The markets freak out. As they freak out, they immediately price in the possibility they're going to have to dump these assets. They then look at the debt-to-GDP ratios in a continent that has higher debt-to-GDP ratios than the Americans and says, hell, if I have to dump this, what am I going to do? I'm going to have to sell on something else to cover the loss in the portfolio. So if I have to price Greece now at X and then have to look at the next most likely thing to get sold, which is Portugal, so Portugal goes from X to X plus 4. And then I have to sell in Greece and Portugal, I'm going to have to find something else, and then I'll sell in Ireland. So suddenly you get this yield spike right across these areas. Now, Ireland went into the crisis with, if I remember correctly, 26 or 13% debt-to-GDP ratio. I get it mixed up with Spain. They were both very low. One was half of the other. So 13 and 26%. Now Spain's in the 80s, and Ireland's over 100. And what happened in the interim period? You've basically bailed out your financial sector and dumped it on the public balance sheet. Again, that great bait and switch. All of this is turbocharged by the fact that you're doing it in a currency union, which means the countries concerned cannot bail out their national banks. And also, because of what happened over the 10 years of bond buying in the euro markets, these banks have become individually too big to fail and collectively too big to bail. And the ECB can't deal with the problem. And then the Germans aren't big enough to liquidate the problem even if they wanted to. So they really are stuck in a rock and a hard place.
You made this point, but I want to underscore this. Going into this crisis in Europe, only Greece had really outlandish debt figures, right? Everyone else is in pretty good shape.
Yeah, and it wasn't even that outlandish. I mean, basically what happened was they had a government that came in and trying to shame the opposition that had just gone out, said, look at these people, they're all total liars. They said the deficit's 7%, it's actually 12. In fact, it's closer to 13. And they didn't expect what would happen is the global bond markets would collectively freak out on the news of something that's the same size as Alabama declaring that it's got a bigger than expected deficit. But what that was doing was pricing in contagion risk. And once you price in contagion risk, Greece just becomes a trigger for Portugal, which becomes one for Ireland, and then very suddenly you're at Spain. And the exposures go from Spain to the French banks, and the French banks have 30% of GDP and periphery debt stuck on their books going nowhere, and they gave their printing press to the Germans. They've got a problem, and they don't know how to fix it.
But it was certainly not a tale of the public sector gone wild with profligacy.
No, absolutely not. Even in the Greek case, if you decompose the figures, you find a half of it went on investment. I mean, where do they think the Athens subway came from? Yeah, another one for this one, the great story of these profligate southerners. Go to stats.oecd.org and go to labour markets and look up hours worked, and then look at who actually does a hard shift in Europe. It's the southerners. The Greeks work 2,000 hours a year. The Germans work 1,200, and yet they're the ones who are supposed to be lazy. So there's a huge amount of political construction of this being some kind of public sector profligacy crisis. And even in the Greek case, which is a tiny, tiny component of Eurozone GDP, it's happened. It's certainly true that they were profligate. But my God, there's been worse examples of that in human history that hasn't caused this much damage. And it's the interlinked nature of these markets through the euro which has caused the problem. Everyone's pricing in a default risk on a currency none of them can control.
Okay, let's turn to the intellectual history of austerity. And this takes us back into the days of Locke and Hume, right? So trace the evolution of this idea for us.
Liberalism has a neuralgia with debt, and whenever the nerve pain of debt flares up, they reach for the aspirin of austerity. Now, why do they do this? They do this for the following reasons. If you go back to Locke, even before Hume and Smith, the foundations of English capitalism and the Glorious Revolution, you basically have a bunch of people that know that in order to get the world they want, they need to take over the state. But the state's the antithesis to this thing that they love called the market. But the reality is markets and states are always closely imbricated. And in fact, if you really want to make markets, it's nice to be in control of the state. So from the Lockean Revolution onwards, this revolution in property and all the rest of it, you have a problem because you now have private property and private wealth, which is a very, very high income skew associated with it if left to its own devices. So you need a state to come in and police those distributions to make it possible. So a quote from Adam Smith, for every rich man there must be 500 poor, and he is always attended by jealousy. Were it not for the firm hand of the civil magistrate, he could never guard his property. Another one from Adam Smith, my favorite quote, to the end of Book 2 of The Wealth of Nations. Civil government, insofar as it is instituted, for the defense of the rich against the poor, or for those who have property against those who have none. Now, you might think that was Marx, but it's Smith. Adam Smith and Scottish Enlightenment, Hume a lot as well, come along and say, okay, how are we going to fund this thing? Because we can't live without it. We can't live with it, but we don't want to pay for it. Hume comes along and says, there's a great wheeze, it's called debt. It seems like it's a free option, but it's a problem. Because the idea is that the state gives me a debt instrument where I get my money back after a certain period of time, and it pays me interest for lending the money. So this is perfect, right? You make the distributions of income and wealth possible that I like, and you pay me for doing it. This is fabulous. The only problem is, in order to make this work, you'd need to offer me a rate of interest higher than that I would get in the market. If I got that rate of interest, I wouldn't invest in the market, so the underlying productive assets in the economy, as Hume puts it, all the gold and silver that would have productive uses, would get diverted into debt securities. Eventually, debt markets would become the only thing that's going on, and eventually the underlying growth would collapse. This is the origins of the crowding out hypothesis. Smith adds to this that ideally you should have progressive taxation because those with the most skin in the game should pay the most for asset protection. But then, in classic Republican style, he turns around and says, but that would be unfair because the rich would pay the most taxes. So therefore, we need a consumption tax, a tax on any consumption above luxuries, just like the Republicans are arguing today. And he says, but there's a problem because that will never raise enough money. So I guess we're stuck with debt. And the problem with debt is, ultimately, it's too easy for states to issue it. We like it too much. It perverts the parsimony of the saver, and ultimately it leads to the ruination of the nation. Now, this is a great story, and all the stories that we hear today are limped up in this. There's Ricardian equivalence, before Ricardo even called it. There's crowding out. There's, you know, all these sort of effects. But the problem was this. When Hume and Smith were writing in the 1770s, British debt was around 30%, 20% of GDP. It rocketed up the end of the Napoleonic Wars over 200% of GDP. So they correctly predicted this massive increase in debt. And then what happened was Britain went on to rule the world for a century and a quarter. So there's a bit of a problem with the debt leads to collapse and enfeeblement story because it led to world domination. Perversely, in part because British securities markets became deep, highly liquid, and therefore led to a great deal of capital accumulation. It's funny how these non-linear effects happen. But that's where the origins of the neuralgia lie, and we're basically just telling versions of the same story today.
Yeah, it's remarkable reading those passages, how, aside from the antique language of several centuries ago, we're still hearing the same things from pundits and editorialists today.
Oh, it's exactly the same arguments. There's a brilliant book by Al Hirschman, the economist, from 1994, I'm sure you know it, called The Rhetoric of Reaction, Perversity, Feudality, and Jeopardy. And he basically says that all arguments against reform could fall into one of those three buckets. And essentially, this is what's going on today, because you have these arguments about debt, which basically say the first one is, well, you know, you can try and spend your way out of it, but you'll end up with more. And of course, the reality is the opposite. The more you try and cut, the more you end up with debt, because you basically slash the GDP and the constant stock of debt gets bigger. But you have a perversity story. You have a futility story, which is, oh, well, you can try and do this, but it will never work, so don't try. And then the last one is you have the jeopardy one, which is, well, if you get to 90%, you just fall off a cliff and then you die. So these things fall into these three buckets and have been said without modification for 300 years. We should probably begin to question them a little bit.
You mentioned the 90% figure, which makes me wonder what you make of the discrediting of the Reinhardt and Rogoff paper.
It's quite interesting. I mean, I've been following this closely, and I've never really put that much stock in it because it's a statistical finding. And I teach this kind of history of economics class, and one of the slides that I give to my students is the Phillips curve for Britain, a statistical finding. And Milton Friedman made great hay out of this with the vertical Phillips curve in the 1970s. There's no long trade-off against unemployment, inflation, and all that sort of stuff. And the numbers in that period, the statistical finding, really seem to support that. I then give them the next slide, which is the British Phillips curve from 1992 to 2007. It's completely horizontal. You can have whatever level of unemployment you want at a constant rate of inflation. And yet we still tell the statistical story of Milton as if it's true. So I look at Reinhardt and Rogoff, and this is a statistical finding. It's just a question of time until it gets debunked, either by time itself or somebody goes and checks the numbers. And in this case, they went and checked the numbers. It doesn't really have that purchase of being part of the intellectual lineage in the way that the expansionary fiscal consolidation work does or whatever, which really sort of ties into the old Smithian and Humean stories. So you find out there's an Excel coding error, fine. You find out there's something strange going on with the weights, fine. At the end of the day, their defense is you still have lower growth when you get to a higher rate of debt. And the Aaron Dubé came along and recalculated the numbers and basically shows the relationship is quadratic. In fact, that the worst place to be is in the middle, and when you have really high debt, there actually tends to be a slightly better growth profile. So at this point, I don't know what to make of that, other than the fact that it's a statistical finding, and on their own, devoid of any basic causal story, I have no reason to believe that a priori.
A lot of this, though, is not really what we would think of as economics, but turns into a morality play, doesn't it?
Yeah, but the entire thing's a morality play. Capitalism is essentially a moral story. That those who basically save will be rewarded and those who spend won't. I mean, go back and read The Wealth of Nations. Parsimony, not industry, is the cause of greatness and wealth. We're all hardwired to barter and truck, but more importantly, we're hardwired to save. So those who save are good and those who spend are bad. And of course, the classic story in this, where it all fell apart in the 1930s, was that you have two sides to the equation. We can't all save at once. You need income from which to save. If we all try and save at the one time, you simply shrink the economy. Somehow that was forgotten, and yet it comes back as expansionary fiscal consolidation. Yet the evidence is in. Every country that since 2009 has tried to cut its way to solvency now has more debt rather than less. Lay it out on a line. Britain's deficit this year is going to be about 7.5%. The United States is going to be under 5%, and Southern Europe's in double figures. We don't need any more evidence to know this is self-defeating, and yet we keep doing it. Why? Because we've cast it as a morality play. They spent too much, and now they need to pay the price, and it's not a morality play.
And a lot of that spending on the periphery of Europe was financed by Germans during the bubble, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Their saving is the cause of their sinning. It's manifestly impossible to have overspending unless somebody on the other side of the equation is overlending. Yet we never blame the banks for overlending. Here's something. I wonder if you can remember this one, Doug. Do you remember in 2003 to 2006, Citibank had a slogan? It was the world's first billion-dollar advertising campaign. Do you remember Citi's slogan from those years?
I do not.
Live richly.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Not be rich, not save up, not do some smart investments. Live richly. It was a money pump. It was a credit pump financed from the private sector. And if you have the largest economy in Europe as a chronic saver because it's an export-led economy, so basically it can never do Keynesian policy even if it wanted to because it doesn't make sense. Because if you simply pump up wages and prices, you end up just killing your exports. Same as Canada as a commodity exporter. So you basically save more than you should. You don't consume enough. Your banks take these surplus savings and then buy periphery debt with it. They know this because they know it's a good deal because they know the euro's coming in. So they're buying it as the yields converge. So they do it by pumping up the volume and doing it with leverage, either this kind of volume plus convergence trade. And you end up stuffed with periphery debt. And your balance sheet becomes so big you become a systemic risk to your regulator. So you're too big to fail, which, as we know from the United States, is a highly successful business model. So all of this begins and ends with the lenders. The creditors are the tail on the dog.
Okay, back to our historical story of the evolution of this idea of austerity. How did it make its way from English origins into the United States?
The U.S. story is fascinating because you basically have a split in 19th century economics. So on the one hand, you've got people like David Ricardo. And David Ricardo's line is basically, markets are fine so long as they're not intervened with by government. My favorite line from Ricardo is, the condition of the poor is always wretched and is likely to be so. But his answer is, so long as prices are flexible, everything will be really cheap, so it doesn't really matter. And down that track follow the Austrian economists. And the Austrian economists, the original ones from von Barwick onwards, through to Mises and Hayek, who end up having a great influence and indeed in some cases residence in the United States, and also Joseph Schumpeter, who becomes the business cycle theorist par excellence at Harvard in the 1920s, they have this story about the long-run capital structure of the economy and how ultimately you get credit distortions from banking, which is not incorrect, by the way. And then this is why you get these booms and therefore you get the bust. And what you need to do, is to quote Mises, is above all, you must curtail consumption. So you get this austerity story coming out, not just a morality play, I like to call it emetic economics. When you've binged on credit, you have to throw up, and that's the price that you pay for resetting the clock. And the problem with the story is if everybody tries that at once, you don't reset the clock. The only way to explain the Great Depression for after 10 years of it not resetting was either that, to quote Andrew Mellon, the competent people that were meant to come along and pick things up singularly didn't show up. Or alternatively, trade unions were pricing everyone out of a job, which in an era of mass unemployment and low wages seemed very, very unlikely. And also why GDP was shrinking across the world. And the answer was because you were doing simultaneous contractions of the five biggest economies in the world. So of course global GDP was shrinking. And of course debt stocks were getting higher. The Brits had 170% of debt to GDP in 1931. By 1933 it was 190. And all they were doing was cutting. The best example of this was Germany, where you had Brüning coming in 1930. The short-term American capital had been pumping up the German economy, left because of a seniority swap in the Young Plan and higher interest rates in the U.S. To balance the budget, they just cut, 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 and cut. the Social Democrats abandoned any attempt to argue against austerity, just as they're doing today. And the vote for a minor party called the Nazis went from below double figures to 18% to 43% in 3 years. So there's a lot of dynamics in here which are extremely familiar and extremely scary. But the American side of the story comes from the Ricardian side to the Austrians, and the Austrians getting into business cycle theory, and that kind of blows up in the 1920s and 30s in their inability to explain why the Great Depression, A, happens, and B, lasts long.
It's funny how Americans talk a different story from what their economic history would suggest. I mean, we're very profligate in the 19th century, defaulted frequently, stole intellectual property, and now, of course, everyone's supposed to pay debts and observe intellectual property with great respect.
Absolutely. You were also the country with the highest tariffs in the world throughout the 19th century while you were stealing other people's technology. Profligacy is always the fault of the sinner, and the creditor always needs to be paid back. Well, the thing is, if you actually look at this through history, the standard story the creditor tells is that there's either inflation, which is bad for creditors, deflation, which is bad for creditors and debtors. They sometimes tell the story that inflation is bad for debtors, but it's nonsense. You have a big mortgage and you've got a fixed rate mortgage, eat away half the value. That was what a lot of people made out in the 1970s. So if you don't do inflation, you don't do devaluation, you don't want to do default, all you're left with is austerity. Well, it's not really true. There's also financial repression. You basically make those captive banks, which are over-levered and on the brink, de facto wards of the state. You take your war bonds, or in this case your 10-year bills, and you reissue them with longer maturities. You pay a lower yield and you run a positive inflation. You eat away the debt. And that's what we did after World War II, and for Britain and America, it was remarkably successful. And what it did was basically turn the place from a place for a regime that benefited creditors to one that benefited debtors. But the only way you can do this is if you basically punish finance. Well, given that they got all their assets bailed in 2008 and 2009, maybe that's just redressing the balance. I don't know. Maybe that's a bit too radical.
That's okay. Now, Germany. How do we explain the German love of austerity without resorting to creaky old notions of national character?
Well, you know, it is interesting that the word for guilt and the word for debt are the same. But, you know, let's put the cultural to one side. I mentioned this a little bit earlier. If you go back to the 19th century, basically Germany has a project of national unification. Bismarck's the lead guy. And they're pretty successful on this. They take back Alsace-Lorraine from the French and consolidate the state and do all this sort of stuff in 1871. And then their economic policy is heavily influenced by the example of the British. So they have this big stock market and all that, and it blows up spectacularly in 1873. At that point in time, Bismarck gets together with the Prussian elites, who've got the agrarian side of the country and the industrial elites, and says, what we're going to do is we're going to build a series of banks, and we're going to take the forced savings from the agrarian sector, we're going to sell the wheat to the Brits, we're going to take the profits from that, we're going to channel that into the industrial sector. You guys are going to basically reverse engineer products, you're going to turn out how to make better steel, better stuff, all the rest of it, and we're going to have basically state-led industrialization to play catch-up with the Brits. If that sounds a lot like Japan, that's because that's where Japan got most of their institutions from when they had the wake-up call in the 1870s around the same time when the black ship showed up in Tokyo Harbor. So you have these models of economic development, which are very, very strongly state-influenced, to say the least, and are based upon exports. Now, the problem with that is for somebody to be exporting, somebody else has to be importing. So from the German point of view, it's been perfectly natural for them, and has worked despite the dismemberment of the country, the failure to win two wars. They've got these industrial combines, Siemens, BASF, these companies. They've been around since the 1870s, and they've survived all this stuff. BMW and Mercedes make world-class products. They make great stuff. They also, because of the undervalued exchange rate that the euro gave them, and then the Deutschmark before that because of the Cold War, make a lot of cheap stuff that makes a lot of money as well. But, you know, it's nice to be barbelled. Now, in that economy, as I mentioned earlier, it makes no sense to be a Keynesian, because if you do demand stimulus, all you're going to do is increase wages and prices and hurt your exports. So you will fight that tooth and nail because it doesn't make any sense. This is why Merkel today is saying, well, if it's Germany on its own, we'd need to raise interest rates. And what people forget about the German success story the past few years, they haven't given their industrial workers a real wage increase in 10 years. How long can you keep that going? Well, America's done it for 25 to 30 years now with the bottom 40% of the income distribution, but that's because we had easy credit to basically smooth it over. They didn't even do that. So you have this big disjuncture now whereby you have a booming export sector, which is contingent upon growth in Asia, a declining export ability in Europe because of austerity, and an increasing income skew because the money's not being redistributed in the way that it used to be. So for the Germans, looking at, you know, austerity policy, politics is the natural thing to do because it works for them. But again, it's a fallacy of composition. We can't all be them. By definition, for Germany to exist, lots of other countries have to not be Germany because we can't all run a surplus. We can't all save at once. And for some reason, that's the bit that they seem very reluctant to admit, in part because if they did, they then have to admit that what's behind all this is a banking crisis and that ultimately the German economy isn't big enough to bail out the whole European system that they've built. So they temporize. They go for austerity, they squeeze, they add liquidity, and they pray the problem goes away.
Some people might be surprised to learn that there's an Italian angle to the austerity party.
There is, actually. It's one of the most interesting parts of the research. So I was struck by the fact that when you read all the stuff on expansionary fiscal consolidation done by Alberto Alessina and Silvia Ardanga at Harvard and others, you notice all the names are Italian. And paper after paper, it was a couple of Swedes, but it was all these Italians. So I started to research this. And the story goes back to the guy who was the head of the Italian Central Bank and first prime minister of Italy after the war, first president of Italy after World War II, Luigi Einaudi. And Einaudi was this fabulous economist. He used to be the Economist magazine correspondent in Italy under Mussolini and all this sort of stuff. And he basically, given that he grows up in Italy, has no trust of the state whatsoever. And he writes these essays about how it'd be great if we had a European Union. Because what it would do is it would enable us to have institutions continent-wide that would stop states spending money and running the inflationary pumps. Now, if I grew up in Italy, I mean, it's a pretty rotten state and has been for a long time. They have terrible growth. They do issue too much debt because it's easier to do than raise taxes. There's a huge amount of corruption, all that sort of stuff. All true. But to generalize this to basically all states are bad, and therefore if you cut them, what happens is people's expectations are revised up because they think they'll pay less taxes in the future. And therefore now, despite the economy falling about your ears and you might not have a job next week, you'll go to IKEA and buy a new couch and that'll cure the recession. Borders on the ridiculous. But where it comes from is from Einaudi, because Einaudi sets up the Bocconi School of Economics in Milan, which is a bit like Virginia public choice economics in the United States, like rent-seeking politicians, all that sort of stuff. And it does all this very fancy work in the 1870s and 1880s. It's also very mathematically teched up. So when you have the big neoclassical revolution in economics in America, the one part of the European Academy which can talk to the Americans are the Bocconi boys. So the Bocconi boys begin to move their PhD students over to America. And guess what? They end up running Harvard University in places like this, telling us stories about expansionary fiscal consolidation. So the whole circle drew around this whole link between Einaudi, this particular brand of fiscal conservatism, and then how this feeds into PhD training in economics and ends up back in the United States, which is then read by European politicians and used as the reason to justify budget cuts in the present. So the story's very fascinating and very circular.
Now, we've been emphasizing mostly the intellectual roots of austerity, but surely there are major material interests behind it as well.
Well, there are, but I just don't like making a distinction between the two. I mean, to go back to the earlier example, right, are regulators politically captured? Yes, but to me the more convincing thing is you're captured to the extent that you see your interests as being the same as the person you're meant to be regulating. And if they've, in a sense, written the instruction manual on how the world works, and it seems how it's very convincing, when you go into a big bank and ask them, well, should the leverage ratio be 30-1 or 40-1, you then turn and say, well, according to Basel II, if you're running your own risk models, you could do this, blah, blah, blah. Yes, I suppose you're okay. You're thinking in terms of the intellectual framework that somebody else has authored. That's the real source of power. So the intellectual and the material for me go absolutely hand in hand in this. And the other way of thinking about it, I don't like to think about just the material interest story, because if you go back to 1977, this is in the back end of Bill Janeway's excellent book, Doing Capitalism and the Innovation Economy. I highly recommend it. And he says, you go back to 1977, J.P. Morgan was a limited partnership with 250 people in it. I would add that Hank Paulson wasn't out of college yet. And then you fast forward to 2007, you've got 62,500 people working for J.P. Morgan. So what happened? Were these 250 guys, or at least 10 of them, sitting around planning the ascent of global finance? No. The world is far more complex, conjunctural, and just like random. And people are around and they capitalize upon political initiatives and they argue for certain things, and you end up with huge nonlinear payoffs to the financial sector because of deregulation and so on and so forth. But the notion that sort of, you know, it's really in somebody's interests Jein, as the Germans say, yes and no. I prefer a much more accidental and cock-up theory of history on that one. So to me, the intellectual and the material stories go together, because whenever you have really, really complex systems and complex environments, and finance is the classic example of this, what gives you power is the ability to arbitrage the information in the system. And that's always a question of knowledge, expertise, knowing the language, setting the rules, all of which is deeply intellectual.
And then finally, let's talk a bit about politics. How well can austerity live with democracy?
I actually think it's a train wreck which has already hit. I'm extremely pessimistic about this. And what really did this to me was doing the cases in the 1930s and looking at how quickly the Japanese military dispensed with democracy once they'd had enough of budget cuts cutting down the military to size. They began an assassination campaign against their own governmental and civilian elite, and even started to take out some of the banking elite. So it can happen very quickly. Again, the example, the German misreading of history on this is truly astonishing. You find Merkel talking about the inflation of the 1920s as the reason for not doing Keynesianism. Let's get the story straight. The inflation of 1923 was caused by deliberate government policy, but it was an attempt to screw the French over reparations rather than any attempt at Keynesian stimulus to bother them. That's complete nonsense. Between 1924 and 1928, the German economy was one of the most stable and one of the fastest growing in Europe. It looked like they turned the corner. Then the American short-term money leaves, they start budget cutting, and a minor party that had been written off in 1928 ends up taking 43% of the vote in 1933. So we have the golden dawn down in Greece. You have southern European polities which are chronically bad at dealing with difference and diversity in immigration. They have rotten demographics. Italy, for example, is 218 out of 231 in terms of the age distribution of the world's countries. Your average Italian is 43.6 years old. So you've got real fiscal and growth problems in these countries that they have to deal with irrespective of austerity. You pile austerity on top of that, and it makes the situation worse. The vote for the center parties begin to crumble and collapse, and they're unable to effectively even argue against austerity. And I find the parallels of the 1920s all too haunting. And these things can change much faster than we think.
The inevitable question, what's the alternative?
The alternative is something that I like to basically throw back at my libertarian friends. They always insist that economies have self-healing properties and we shouldn't intervene. So I've got an agreement with them. Don't intervene. Austerity is an intervention. It's a huge one. First, do no harm being the first rule of medicine. There's a myopia here in the way that we talk about this, that whenever the government does something, it's an intervention. But whenever you cut the government, it's not an intervention. But it's a myth that government and the markets are not co-determinant. Have a look at the effects of the sequester, and that's a relatively minor cut. So when you whack out 20% of GDP, unless you're willing to tell some fantasy story about how when the government buys a computer and it approves an NIH grant at a public university by a research chemist who invents a molecule that revolutionizes biotech, that's a deadweight loss. And then when the worst author in the world buys a Mac laptop and sits at home and never publishes anything, that somehow adds to GDP. Unless you're willing to make that kind of ridiculous equivalence, then you have to admit that austerity is a determined intervention. So fine, first do no harm. We have not been cutting in the United States, relatively speaking, and we're growing. The Brits have been cutting, and they have their own currency. They're flatlined. Southern Europe has been cutting like you cannot believe. The Greeks have lost 30% of GDP. Nothing is happening except the economy is falling off a cliff. The idea that the Commission turns around and says, yes, but look at the current account, it's getting better. Well, it would do because demand has collapsed to a point that no one can afford imports. So let's say we have the fantasy now that every country in Europe runs an export surplus. Who's going to buy it all? Martin Wolf put this beautifully in the Financial Times. He said, who's going to buy all this stuff? Martians? So we have a real natural experiment running now that shows that the first thing you should do is not do it. When you don't do it, the economy might well, even without massive stimulus, start to turn the corner. And then when it starts to turn the corner, the best thing for curing debt is growth. And if you add to that some financial repression to claw back the fact that you basically did the greatest bait and switch in human history to bail out the financial sector and give them asset protection and income protection, then maybe you just might turn the corner without having to turn on the Keynesian pumps all that much.
Now, a new speaker on the show. This is a 2013 interview of author Les Leopold.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Want to make $1 million an hour? Some people do. Hedge fund managers. The top manager earned $2.4 million an hour in 2010. How long would it take you to make that on your present rate of earnings? Probably decades. How do they do that? Where does all that money come from? It turns out much of the wealth sloshing around at the tippy top has actually come from the 99.9% below. Les Leopold's new book, How to Make $1 Million an Hour, reveals the links between the obscene levels of wealth made by hedge fund managers and such financial crises as the European sovereign debt crisis and the mortgage meltdown. He shows how hedge funds bet against investors and won, beggaring people, school districts, unions, and municipal governments so some people can pull down millions of dollars per hour. Les Leopold's last book was the acclaimed Looting of America. He's executive director of the Labor Institute and Public Health Institute in New York and also writes for Alternet. How to Make $1 Million an Hour. What an attractive title. Tell us a little bit about why you pitched this title the way it was.
Well, I was very concerned about our normal dialogue about inequality. It goes something like this. We say, okay, there are lots of rich people and there's poor people and it's too bad they're poor people and we should probably tax the rich to help the poor. That's sort of the liberal version of the argument. And the assumption is that how these super wealthy people make their money is A, legitimate, B, worthwhile to the U.S. economy, that they are the, you know, the makers. And we never dig in to what they really do. I had come across some astounding incomes that these people make in finance. And I wanted to ask the question of whether or not what they do produces value in connection with all that money they make. For example, it is assumed that in our economy, if you get paid a lot, it must mean you're making a heck of a contribution. Okay, so if you're Lady Gaga, it means a lot of people like your music and you make a lot of money because they like your music and products get sold around you, etc. So I wanted to see what the phenomena was for people that make 100 times what Lady Gaga makes or 100 times what Bruce Springsteen makes.
Let's go right to some of these numbers. What does 100 times what Lady Gaga makes mean?
The top hedge fund earner earned $2.4 million an hour in 2010. That's after the financial crash hit. That was the equivalent of what an average family makes in 47 years. I knew there's something had to be wrong with that. It's not possible for one person to produce that much value in exchange for that amount of money. There had to be something else going on. So let's say the top 10 musicians in this country, their average income is about $24,000 an hour, which is a lot. We can understand what they do. But here's somebody making 100 times that. And we have no idea what they do. So this book is about figuring out what do they do? Does it produce any real value for our economy? And if it doesn't, then we have to delegitimize them because that group of people, they set the bar for inequality in this country. If some 40-year-old hedge fund trader is making hundreds of millions of dollars a year, you can bet that every CEO in the country wants to make a lot more money too. So the bar is set by these high-flying financiers. So we better understand what they're doing, or we have no hope, I think, of dealing with inequality.
You use a rubric of a guide to the rest of us to get to that 1%. But before we kind of dive into the meat of this, I think a lot of people think that they have a shot at it. But you don't think most of us really have a shot at becoming a hedge fund manager who can make $1 million an hour.
Well, first of all, we're talking about the 100th of the top 1%. We're talking about the people who have the highest incomes in the United States. And you have a shot of winning the lottery. You have a shot at this as well. But what might hold you back is your ethics, which is you don't get to the top without cutting a few corners, ethical corners. For example, as the district attorney from New York raised the question of whether hedge funds, in fact, had a fundamentally corrupt business model. He had found so much outright law-breaking among hedge funds that he questioned whether or not the whole thing was based on a corrupt business model. I don't know if that's the case, but I think, as the book I think shows pretty clearly, most of what they do that makes a huge amount of money, the rest of us would call cheating. So there's a big question about whether or not they produce anything positive for the economy.
Okay, so first of all, I think all of us have a vague idea of what a hedge fund is, but what is a hedge fund?
A hedge fund is basically an investment fund for the super rich. You have to have a minimum income of $200,000 to participate in the hedge fund, and you have to have a net worth of $1 million. Institutions, large institutions also use hedge funds to invest. And the key message of a hedge fund is they are saying that we will get you a higher return than you can get in any kind of standard investment, like a mutual fund or in the stock market. And that extra return they call alpha. So alpha is what they get minus what you could get by just investing in the regular old stock market. And this itself is a kind of interesting concept, because basically wealthy people believe that because they're wealthy, they're entitled to make a higher rate of return than everybody else by just giving their money to somebody else. So I'm super rich. I give my money to a hedge fund manager. I expect to get double digit returns. Even now, while most people are getting virtually nothing, they're expecting huge returns. By the way, that's the secret of Bernie Madoff. The reason people didn't question Bernie Madoff is he gave them that 12% return year in, year out, 1% a month. And the people who gave him money felt they were entitled to that return, that that's the privilege of being rich. So we took a look at what people, how they create these alpha returns. How is it possible for someone to make a huge return by managing money? How do they do that? So the book is broken into kind of a step-by-step guide of the various ways that that you can go about making your $1 million an hour.
I think a lot of folks might be confused between equity funds and hedge funds. You know, people talk about, well, Wall Street is really important because these are the job creators, the people who provide the money for investment in the kinds of industries that are going to hire people. Talk about that.
Yeah, let's cut through the... Let me tell you how the guy made his $2.4 million an hour. And then you can, the listener, and you can decide on whether this is worthwhile. Here's what happened. The guy colluded with Goldman Sachs to create a financial instrument that was designed to fail so he could collect the insurance on the failure. All right, that sounds weird, right? Let me put it in the most parochial terms. Imagine a builder builds a house that's designed to burn up. He's done the wiring precisely in a way that guarantees within 6 months it'll burn up. And then the builder takes out a insurance policy on the house so that he can collect the insurance. That's what they did with this financial instrument. What they did was they gathered together the worst subprime mortgages they could find in the worst areas of the country that were beginning to go into default. And they enticed investors to put up $1 billion thinking that this was a good investment that was actually going to gain in value and that they were going to get a nice interest rate from these mortgages. They didn't know that the mortgages that were contained in here were failing rapidly and would fail rapidly. Basically, the money that these investors put up, they were acting as an insurance company. And the hedge fund guy was paying premiums to them. That was their interest rate. But if the default rate reached a certain level, he would take the entire insurance claim. He would get the $1 billion. So he designed the instrument so that it would fail so he could collect $1 billion. Now, what's interesting, obviously, somebody didn't tell the investors what was really going on. The government investigated. Goldman Sachs had to pay a $450 million fine for not being honest with the investors. But the hedge fund guy got to keep his $1 billion.
Are you talking about the Magnetar trade?
Actually, I wasn't, but all the big banks did it. A hedge fund called Magnetar did it. A Citigroup did it. JP Morgan Chase did it. They all did this. They all saw that the housing market was starting to go sour, and they found a way to milk it. And the hedge fund folks were designing these things so they would explode. It wasn't just a crash was happening and they were betting against the market. And they were these great analysts that figured out the housing boom had gone too far and they were going to make money when it was collapsing because they were smarter than the banks and smarter than all these other investments. No, they don't play it that way. You don't make this kind of money by just making bets. You make this money by rigging your bet. You don't risk $1 billion on a bet. When this guy put up his $1 billion, he designed the product so that it would fail and collapse. the Wisconsin school system somehow got hooked up in a bet like this, and they put up $200 million. These are five school districts in Wisconsin, and their bet went sour in 6 months. When I first read that, I thought, oh, what terrible luck. I mean, they shouldn't have been, you know, they shouldn't have gambled on this. They shouldn't have, you know, gotten involved in high finance, and whoever advised them, you know, is crazy. And I, you know, investigated that one very carefully in my last book. But I was naive. They didn't just have bad luck. They were sold something that was designed to explode in 6 months. The whole gambling around these subprime mortgages on the way up and on the way down, that the hedge funds were involved on both sides, that was what caused the housing bubble. And that's what caused the explosion in the housing bubble as well, why it went down so quickly. By doing what they did, they accelerated the crash.
So you're saying basically these hedge funds, what they did is they kind of bundled up all these really shaky mortgages. They picked out the worst possible mortgages that they could find, the one that they knew were going to go under. And that's what they sold as a good investment to, like, this Wisconsin school system. And so what did Goldman Sachs, or what did the banks have to do with it? Because they were in collusion. What did they get out of it?
Oh, they got enormous fees. First of all, they get the hedge fund's business. There's fees up and down the line on this. And they also got to unload any trash that they had warehoused on their books. They got to get rid of stuff that they had lying around that they didn't want to have. They got rid of their risky stuff. Matter of fact, I'm almost certain that's what happened in the Wisconsin case. It didn't even have to be housing stuff. It could be car loans, whatever debt instruments they had that they wanted to protect themselves from crashing, they threw them into this stuff. So there's a lot in it from the banks, huge amount. Also, banks invest in hedge funds. Banks have internal operations that are just like hedge funds. So people are going back and forth between the banks and the hedge funds. This is a very symbiotic relationship, highly profitable on both sides. It's even weirder, though, than you just described. They didn't assemble real mortgages. That's not the way they play this game. They assemble bets on real mortgages.
So they don't actually own a lot of these mortgages.
Nope. They don't own any of them. For those people who understand how fantasy sports works, fantasy baseball, you can pretend to own something and make a bet on it without actually owning it. And that's how they construct these things. They don't have to worry about the mess and bother of actually owning a subprime mortgage. They can just go look for the worst areas where there are these subprime mortgages and then make the bets on them.
Now, you mentioned before how the whole use of these instruments, betting on the failure of the housing market, as well as the rapid velocity of trades and trading, really contributed to the crash and to the intensity of the crash. There's another area in which you connect the dots between hedge funds that operate around currencies and the crisis that's affecting Europe, the sovereign debt crisis. Now, this was a wholly new thing to me. And for this, you start out with one of the icons of liberalism. That's George Soros. And he doesn't come out smelling exactly like a rose here. Tell us what happened. How did he make his billion or $5 billion? Connect the dots for us.
George Soros was the first person in the hedge fund business to figure out that not only can you make big bets, but you can actually shape events so that the bet will succeed. So he got involved in a complicated period in the growth of the European Union. George Soros understood perfectly well that it was a good thing for Europe to create a common market because there had been two world wars. His family had been extremely impacted by what happened in World War II. But there was a golden opportunity that was created because on the way to creating the euro, countries had to keep their currencies within a certain level. And if the currency got went outside that level, the central bank of the country had to do something to bring it back into line. And how they do that is kind of complicated for kind of an on-the-air explanation. But basically, Soros and his partners bet that England would be unable to maintain its currency within this range. So they basically placed a huge bet that it wasn't going to happen. And by placing that big bet, they were in fact dragging the currency out of the realm. And they were able to throw together basically a $1 billion bet. But when other people saw that he was doing it, they piled on too. And they literally created the outcome that they wanted to see happen. And as a result, the money was a transfer from the British people. The net result of what happened was that the people of England ended up having to lose many billion dollars that were transferred to these banks and these traders in banks and in hedge funds who were trying to destabilize the currency. And what's really interesting about this is 20 years earlier, James Tobin, the Yale Nobel laureate, had predicted that this very kind of thing was going to happen, that if we let money move rapidly around the world and we let these traders, currency, used to call them just speculators, if we let these hedge funds speculate on currencies, that they would be able